I'm very delighted to be back in Seattle again. And as I look out, I realize that many of you I recognize and have really known for quite a few years. And I'm imagining that some of you are also perhaps newer to meditation practice and perhaps newer to the Dharma. So it's always a little bit of a question for me to find a theme or to find a subject that hopefully will mean something to everyone. And it's interesting, this time of my life in teaching and practicing and reflecting myself, I find myself increasingly drawn to very many of the early texts, the early texts in the Pali Canon, and being re-inspired in many ways by the elegance of the Buddhist teaching that is held within those texts. So I think more and more I'm becoming this sort of classical Buddhist teacher. You know, after some many years, not being so much that. So tonight, what I'd like to talk about is a theme that the Buddha touched upon again and again and again in his teaching. And it's a theme that I think, if it's not as equally relevant to us today as it was 2,500 years ago, it may be more relevant to us today than it was 2,500 years ago. So the theme I want to really speak to tonight is the theme of contentment. Is this volume all right for everyone? Yeah? So the theme of contentment, and particularly centering around what the Buddha called the four great contentments. Now, some 2,600 years ago, exhausted by years of struggling and striving and resisting, the young disheartened and somewhat disappointed Siddhartha recalled a time as a young boy when he sat on a hillside overlooking his father's land, and he saw a farmer plowing his field. And Siddhartha remembered that there had arisen in him an unexpected and unsought for, yet very powerful and sublime sense of contentment. That there was no thought in him of going anywhere, no thought in him of anything that he had to get rid of. There was no sense in that moment that there was anything missing. And when Siddhartha remembered that moment, he remembered it as a time of a remarkable ease and sense of joy and stillness. And he remembered it as a moment of profound contentment. Now that memory for Siddhartha was a very powerful turning point in his quest for liberation, because that memory really encouraged Siddhartha to look at what the difference is between aspiration and striving. It called him to, in a way, to really re-examine or maybe even to examine for the very first time some of the very powerful urges that had driven him in his life to look outside of himself, to look to the future, to look elsewhere for the happiness and the peace and the freedom that he felt to be lacking in himself. And I think that memory also encouraged or made Siddhartha question whether the freedom he really sought for was going to be born of something that he gained, or what he could let go of. Now, throughout the Buddhist teaching, from the very early days, this teaching of contentment as a quality and as a cultivation is something that is repeated time and time again. If you read the discourse on loving kindness, on metta, you come across the teaching of contentment. Sometimes the teaching of contentment is used almost interchangeably with the words peace or joy. And contentment is something that features very strongly in many of the descriptions of the liberated and the free heart. In the talk this evening, I'd also like to draw on a little bit of early Chan poetry. And one of the nuns, the early nuns in the Chan tradition, I think she spoke to this quality of contentment when she wrote, "The entire day I searched for spring, but spring I could not find. In my straw sandals, I tramped amongst the mountain peak clouds. Home again, smiling, I finger a sprig of fragrant plum blossom. Spring was right here on these branches in all of its glory." This poem speaks to coming back, from that driven sense of prowling the world of things, and prowling the world of experiences, to come back to our own hearts and to question what in this moment is truly lacking. Now, I would encourage you to reflect upon whether you can remember yourself any moment of deep contentment in your life. Perhaps just a moment of stepping out into a fall morning and seeing the leaves beginning to change on the tree and feeling a sense of being touched by the loveliness that you see around you. Can you remember a moment or moments where you felt that sense of sufficiency and of being able just to relax into the moment, relax into stillness? If you can remember those moments when you have felt in yourself a cooling of all the waves of agitation about, you know, where we need to go, what we need to become, what we need to get rid of. And in those moments, have you ever felt that sense, that felt sense of your heart unbinding, a heart of deep ease? And perhaps, you know, these have not been just momentary glimpses in your life. Perhaps you can even remember longer moments when all sense of insufficiency and lack falls away, because this is what contentment is really speaking to. It's about the falling away a sense of insufficiency and lack. And when that fades away, what actually awakens, I think, in us in those moments of contentment is a very deep felt sense of being able to be present in the presence of all things. Now, if we can reflect or touch upon any of those moments in our life when that sense of contentment has been present, what do they teach us? What do those moments teach us about the nature of happiness and the nature of unhappiness? The Buddha certainly speaks of contentment as the greatest of all blessings. The Dalai Lama, in speaking to this very kind of central teaching, he said, if one cultivates simplicity, contentment comes. Simplicity is extremely important for happiness. Having few desires, feeling satisfied with what you have is very vital. Satisfaction with just enough food, clothing, and shelter to protect us from the elements. And finally, there is intense delight in abandoning faulty states of mind and cultivating helpful ones. Now, I think sometimes when we hear the word contentment, you know, images of cows grazing in a field might arise, you know, moving kind of, you know, slothfully from mouthful to mouthful. But I think as a doorway to contentment, that as a doorway to the freeing our hearts, the quality of contentment that the Buddha speaks about is not a bovine contentment. Nor is it a prescription for resignation or passivity or surrender of aspiration. Instead, the way that the Buddha speaks about contentment is a way of being which is content and yet fully alive and vital and the beginning of a life of freedom. Now, I think in talking about contentment tonight, I think it's very, very important to give you a little bit of a historical context for this teaching. If you think about what it might have been like 2,600 years ago, in the early days of the Buddha's teaching, when the early men and women would leave their homes, their culture, their families, to join the Buddha in a homeless life. And to think about what a radical step that would have been in India at that time, in a culture already where so little was certain, so little could be relied upon. And yet to be able and willing to even put that down and to join the Buddha in this life of complete insecurity, complete uncertainty, never knowing where your next meal would come from, never knowing if you would have shelter that night, never knowing whether you would have the support to live. Now, the ability in making that step, the ability to rest in a contented heart, was a key to that life being a life of peace and freedom rather than a life of desolation and deprivation. Now, that is, of course, just as true for nuns and monks today as it was in those early days. Now, in those early days, the first instructions that were given to the nuns and monks were the teachings in the four great contentments. And the Buddha would say, be content with any robe you are given, whether it is lovely or shabby, or even if you are not given a robe at all. And even here, the Buddha very much cautioned against poverty conceit, kind of knowing the ingenuity of the human mind. And to paraphrase it, he said something along the lines like, don't think that just because you're content with some shabby old robe, that it makes you a better nun or monk than Sally or Joe down the robe, you know, who's got some really fine robe. He would say, be content with any food you are given, whether it's the scraps from the table or a gourmet meal, or even if you're given no food at all. And then he would say, be content with any lodging you are given, aware of what lodging is for, and not worrying if you're given no lodging at all. And again, the Buddha would again and again encourage against conceit, not using our own simplicity or contentment as a way of judging others. And the fourth great contentment was to discover the happiness again born of letting go of what is unhelpful and the happiness of developing an unbounded heart and freedom. Now, clearly, what the Buddha was talking about here in this teaching of contentment was the attitude, The attitude that we have in relationship to all things. He wasn't teaching endurance. He didn't find a virtue in deprivation. He wasn't teaching the cultivation of misery, but the cultivation of joy. Now, of course, we might say, well, you know, this is really fine for monks and nuns, but what about us as lay people? You know, what does this teaching have to do with us as lay people? Because, and I think it has a lot to do with us. Because I mean, the teaching of contentment is not about what we have, and it's not about what we don't have. But the teaching of contentment is no longer agreeing to the world of conditions, whether it's food, clothing, stature, or experience. No longer agreeing to the world of conditions being the gatekeeper of our happiness and freedom. It's the essence of this teaching. If we think, if you can think, if I think of any single moment when I'm wrestling with the world of conditions, whether I'm wrestling or arguing with the weather or the room I have or my cushion, if I think of any moment when I'm struggling with the world of conditions and the thoughts are arising in my mind of, oh, I really need this, or I really can't bear this, or I must have this, or I really have to get rid of this, you know what that moment is? It's instant unhappiness. You've noticed? Every moment you agree, or I agree to the world of conditions being the gatekeeper of my happiness, I am instantly unhappy. I am instantly suffering. And what am I suffering? I am really experiencing the suffering of discontent. Now, none of us would argue, I think, that there are plenty of conditions in life that are really difficult, you know, that can be quite painful to be with, that are truly demanding, whether it is, you know, ailments of our body, whether it is difficult people in our lives, whether it is our world's crumbling at times. Conditions can be difficult. They are not neutral. But we need to question or really explore for ourselves whether the conditions in our life have ever held the power to project us into distress and anxiety and feelings of insufficiency. Or whether this is a power we have given or handed to the world of changing, uncertain, unpredictable conditions. Now, central to the teaching of contentment in the Buddha's understanding was that the source of joy and the source of struggle, the source of content and the source of discontent lies in our own hearts and not in the world of conditions. Kabir had something to say to this. He said, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world. I keep spinning out of myself. I gave up expensive clothes and bought a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I stopped being a sexual elephant, and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I finally gave up anger, and now I notice I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself." We keep thinking often, don't we, if I just got rid of this and I just altered this and I just changed this and I just became this, then I would surely find that elusive contentment. And yet sometimes the whole thing just becomes more refined and the argument becomes more refined, but I'm still arguing and I know it. I think what Kabir is speaking to in this poem is that every moment of discontent, it's a little bit like that fourth heavenly messenger of the wandering renunciate in the crowd. It's a little bit like that fourth heavenly messenger waving at us. Every moment we feel the surge of distress, of I don't like this, I need this, I must have this. It's like that surge has written on it the invitation just to stop for a moment, just to be still, to be aware of where we are delivering the calm and the peace and the sufficiency of our own hearts into the world of conditions. Conditions that we can't always control, but conditions that we are asked to learn what it means to be at peace with. Now, contentment, I think, is I don't think of contentment so much as a feeling, as a state. I think of contentment, or one of the ways to understand contentment, is about understanding what we're choosing to do with our attention. Now, have you noticed how easy it is to feed discontent? I mean, it could be about anything, isn't it? I mean, you could get up tomorrow morning and be raining, and that could, like be the story of your day, you know? Why is it always raining here? I need to move somewhere where it's not raining. If I moved somewhere where it was not raining, I'd be really happy, you know? Maybe all I need is a brief vacation in the sun, then I'd be really happy and willing to deal with the rain. Have you noticed how easy it is to feed discontent? You know, someone crosses your path in the traffic, and the whole world becomes out to annoy you and disgruntle you, someone doesn't return your smile, and you have a day of lingering and all the memories of rejection going right back to you when you were 3 years. If you notice how easy it is to feed discontent, it's almost like a full-time job. We can do that with our attention. Feed discontent with association, with thought, with insistence, with demand. Or we can learn to return just to this moment, to calm the waves and to cultivate contentment. That's why I think of contentment not so much as a state. The Buddha talked about contentment as a path, as a cultivation. I think David White speaks to this in this short piece of a poem. He says, enough, these few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. Now, 2,600 years ago, the Buddha identified the force of craving. Craving, unquenchable thirst, as just one of the very few forces that hold the power to dispossess us of freedom and contentment. He identified the force of craving as having a power to cause immense struggle and suffering and distress. He likened craving to a thief that takes up residence in our hearts with the mission to convince us of insufficiency. To steal the contentment and freedom that is possible in each moment. That craving in taking up residence in our hearts seems to send us to prowl and roam the world for what we believe to be lacking in ourselves. The Buddha had really a lot to say about craving, and any of you who are at all familiar with the Buddha's teaching will know this well. And the Buddha also provided a roadmap of craving that I think is really useful, because I think it's a roadmap that we can all follow in our minds and hearts. And because this roadmap of craving, in a way, is a roadmap of suffering, it is then also the roadmap of freedom and the roadmap of contentment. Because the Buddha never talked about freedom as being somehow something realized through transcending suffering, but through looking at the ways that suffering and struggle is created, that there is the key to understanding the end of suffering. So let's just look a little bit at this roadmap of craving and seeing whether you can relate to it at all. The craving for sensual pleasure, the craving for becoming, and the craving for non-becoming. I'll go into each of these. So let's look first at the craving for sensual pleasure. Now, we need to really be very careful here, you know, because we need to acknowledge there are countless moments of loveliness each day. Moments of appreciating the bird in the sky, the sun, the loveliness at times encountered in our minds. The lovely thoughts, the lovely emotions of kindness and generosity and empathy. And it is very, very important in this teaching to know how to appreciate and to delight in those moments of loveliness, because the lovely gladdens our hearts. The lovely brings a sense of spaciousness and a sense of connectedness. And sometimes I get the feeling, particularly, you know, maybe in the West, that too many people in practice, in this tradition, feel almost afraid of the lovely, you know, as if it's a kind of more noble and virtuous practice and life if we're spending every possible moment grappling with suffering. But the lovely is part of the fabric of our life experience, and in many ways, when we are really, really present with the lovely, we can get such a taste of contentment, such a taste of settling, such a taste of that moment when nothing feels to be lacking, such a taste of sufficiency. The pleasant has never been presented in this teaching as a problem or as an obstacle. But we do probably, in all honesty, acknowledge how easy it is for something else to creep into the pleasant. Just the simple, I would like more of it. You know, I would like it to stay. I would like it to last. I would like it to remain the same. You know, it's lovely outside, but it probably looks better from the top of the hill, you know. Dinner was good, I'm coming back here tomorrow, you know. A thought pops up in our mind about someone we enjoy or like, and, you know, it seems like the perfect moment to just have an amazing fantasy about that person. We even see how craving immediately finds it not enough just to be with the lovely. It's kind of like hijacks the lovely. And even has the power to destroy the lovely. You know, I teach in a place in Switzerland, and the center is, you know, really high up in the Alps, you know, and you look outside the window of the meditation room, and it's like this most extraordinary sight, you know, of these high Alps, you know, every time you open your eyes. And it truly is beautiful. And I remember teaching there a few years ago, and of course everybody who comes to practice there, you know, tends to sort of go into these rapturous stories about how amazingly beautiful it is. And I was, you know, appreciating this person telling me this. And then I met them again on the retreat a year later. And they were talking about how disappointed they felt because it wasn't quite as beautiful as they remembered. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, impermanence, I know about impermanence, but, you know, in my experience, like, the Alps really didn't change that much in a year, you know. And I'm pretty sure they were just absolutely as beautiful as they were the previous year. But somehow the mind couldn't see it. The mind couldn't see it because the mind somehow can get stuck in what was and the demand for the repetition of the same experience. So instead of meeting that moment anew, that person anew, that sound anew, it's kind of like it's just not enough anymore, is it? We can even begin rather perversely to try to use craving to get rid of suffering. You know, the Buddha so much talks about craving and unquenchable thirst being the cause of suffering, the feeder of insufficiency. But if we don't see that, we try to use craving to get rid of suffering, you know? I have an unpleasant mind state, I have an unpleasant sitting, I have an unpleasant body experience. We have so much available to us in our culture to fix that, don't we? You know, I'll just turn on the TV, I'll open the fridge, you know, I'll pick up the phone. And so we compound suffering and we use craving to try to get rid of suffering. What's really happening in the craving for sensual pleasure is the endeavor, and I might mention, I think it's a fairly futile endeavor, to try to create a world where we only have pleasant sensation. It's fairly doomed to failure in my experience. But what we're really saying, and what the subtext in that is, the subtext is, I can only be happy in the face of pleasant sensation and experience. That's kind of our subtext. And contentment can feel very, very far away when we're always looking forward, isn't it? And when we're leaning forward, the better moment, the better experience, you know, the better person, the better mind state. I mean, those moments, contentment feels so far away, but I think it's really important to question whether that is true. Or whether contentment is actually right here, in cooling the fires of craving, in learning to be still. I'd like to share with you just another piece of one of these early Chan poems. When the young monk writes, spring morning on the lake, the wind merges with the rain. Worldly matters are like flowers that fall only to bloom again. I retire to contemplate behind closed doors, a place of true joy, while the floating clouds come and go the whole day long. Now the craving to become is a kind of, again, a many-layered one. Because the craving to become on one layer, you know, has to do with like all of those fantasies we entertained as children, as perhaps as adults, as about, you know, what we want to become or need to become in this life, you know. You might have remembered them as, you know, as children, the fantasies you might have had, you know, growing up to be this sort of, you know, Madonna or Jimi Hendrix or, you know, the president or, you know, whatever was your passing fantasy of the moment. And of course, a lot of those fantasies are distant memories. But I think we don't always acknowledge really how discontented we can be with who and how we are. You know, so sometimes the craving to become becomes much more subtle, you know. Even, you know, the craving to become the most fantastic meditator in the world, you know. The craving to be peaceful, the craving to become happy, the craving even to become enlightened, if it's a craving. But that craving to become something other, it's almost like a kind of existential discontent. Can be almost like the existential discontent of not feeling enough, not feeling good enough, that launches us into the craving to become. And of course that craving to become is the craving that divorces us from what we're actually feeling, actually experiencing in this moment. And in the movement to reject and to abandon and to disconnect from what is, it's a movement away not only with our discontent with who we are, But I think it's also a movement away from our capacities for acceptance and for kindness and for compassion. And again, it's easy to use craving as a kind of solution. You know, if I'm not at peace with who and how I am, I'm going to fix that by becoming someone or the person who is having a different kind of experience. Because this is often the craving to become. We don't want to be the person who's having this particular kind of experience. You know, I see this sometimes, you know, in retreats, you know, where someone will tell me, you know, like I'm a therapist. I shouldn't be having, you know, unhappy thoughts. You know, or more common, someone will come and tell me, you know, I'm an experienced meditator. I shouldn't be falling asleep. We don't want to be the person who's having that kind of experience. We want to become this person who's having this other kind of experience, you know, this bright, alert, you know, bushy-tailed yogi. Because that's more acceptable to us in our eyes of what is acceptable. We want to be the kind of person, you know, maybe who has more stillness or who is more perfect. The kind of person who's more kind, you know, more generous. Now here we need to really look at this difference between aspiration and craving, don't we? Because if you look at the Buddhist teaching, of course it is peppered with this aspirational sense. To nurture, cultivate kindness, our capacity for generosity, our capacity for compassion. But there's a very, very fine line between that aspirational sense and this craving to become, which is based upon rejecting the kind of experience and therefore the kind of person we believe ourselves to be. It's such a fine line. The craving for non-existence is the third kind of craving. Now, and of course, in its most extreme sense, this is to be suicidal. To want something, to need something, to go away, to disappear, to be over, to be annihilated. Now, this obviously, this craving for non-existence, again, has so many layers. It's not just to do with it's to do with much that is happening around us and much that is happening within us. And it's so interesting, this craving for non-existence, you would know it more familiarly as aversion, arises primarily, of course, in relationship to the unpleasant, doesn't it? I mean, we don't usually have the craving for non-existence of the pleasant. But it's so interesting in the way that there's no modulation in aversion often. You know, I mean, we can have the same intensity of aversion to the sound of a dog barking at the window or a minor cough in the room as we have to some major experience of disappointment and failure. It's the fear of being overwhelmed. But it gets met with the same reaction. You know, unpleasant events, people, experiences, sensations, emotions, feelings. The fear of not being able to bear. The fear of being lost. The fear of being overwhelmed. It's such a powerful force that leads us to reject and to disdain and to blame, which of course makes us more fearful. Now, this all sounds like very bad news so far, but we're going to move on. There's another chapter here. Now, when we begin to track the movement of craving in our day, in our mind, in our heart, I really encourage you to do that. Really look at this. You know, this is not something abstract. Really track this in your day. Look at how much the mind is actually entangled in craving. And when we do that, it often can feel so disheartening. Because it can feel so pervasive and so pernicious, it's almost inconceivable to imagine its end. But to imagine what would our life, what would our mind, what would our heart look like in the cessation of craving. But that is what we are invited to imagine in this path. That's what we're invited to conceive of. The Buddha speaks about the nibbana. The Buddha speaks about liberation, not as the extinguishing as light of life. He doesn't even necessarily speak about nibbana or liberation as some ultimate breakthrough experience, but as a practice of blowing out the fires of craving. And he speaks about liberation and nibbana as the practice of cultivating contentment in the face of all the powerful surges of craving that arise. Now, where do we cultivate contentment? Well, in all the moments we find ourselves leaning forward into the future that hasn't arrived, in all the moments we find ourselves struggling to become something other, to experience something other than what we're experiencing, we cultivate contentment. In all the moments we find ourselves pushing away what is being experienced, knowing these moments are not bad or wrong, but this is a path of unhappiness. And every moment we can cultivate that quality of uprightness, of stillness, of being present with what is. It is a moment of cultivating contentment, of cooling the fires of craving and cooling the fires of suffering. This is not a sacrifice of aspiration, not a sacrifice of all the longings that bring us to practice, that bring us here, the longings for peace, the longings for connectedness, the longings for freedom, the longings for intimacy and compassion. Those longings are so, so central in this teaching. In fact, you know, if you look at this teaching, the kind of strata of desire, you know, one word for craving is tanha, unquenchable thirst. But there is another word, which is chanda. And chanda speaks to this wholesomeness of desire, the wholesomeness of longing that really speaks to the heart of this path, not surrendering our longings. And because in many ways, all of that longing for the wholesome, all of that wholesome, you know, the generosity, the kindness and compassion, in many ways, they're really not separate from the fabric of contentment. In many ways, in all of those qualities, you have a taste of contentment. And actually, in knowing that distinction between aspiration and craving, I think this poem from the early Chan tradition speaks to this. The yogi writes, "I urge those of you who aspire to enlightenment. In aspiring to enlightenment, you must be diligent. If your mind is not completely sincere, you will wallow forever in the bitter sea. The great earth is vast and without limit, and sentient beings are too many to count. Yet how many people are there with the sense to leap out of the bitterness of struggle?" Now, we don't always see craving as craving, but we do see agitation and restlessness, I think, much more easily. It's a much more kind of visible, perceptible feeling for us, you know, that the inner squirm. The agitation and restlessness, we just not being it, you know, where stillness feels so far away, where our minds are full of thoughts and plans, you know, when our eyes are prowling the world, when we feel waves of impatience or frustration, all of this agitation is actually the visible face of discontent. And if we're willing, just in those moments, to look beneath that first layer of agitation and ask what its root is, what do we see? Usually craving. Craving for something more, craving to become, craving to get rid of. And if we look just a little bit underneath that layer of craving, what do we see? Ah, sense of insufficiency or a belief in insufficiency. And if we can find in ourselves the collectedness to look surges of craving in the eye, we'll probably find that tied up in that sense of insufficiency, the anxiety of me is lurking. You know, the anxiety of me is kind of pervading through those waves. Insufficiency, you know, the belief of not having enough, of not being enough, is really the belief system of the anxiety of me. And I think this is what goes right to the heart of the teaching of liberation. Because if the anxiety of me, if that belief system is left unquestioned, then discontent and its offspring of craving and agitation will follow just like night follows day. I think it's a very simple, it's a very traceable, but it's not a very easy truth. But if we don't make our home in agitation and follow its waves, then we're not making our home in craving. And if we don't make our home in craving and follow its waves, we are not making our home in the belief in insufficiency. And I think this goes really to the heart of the teaching of contentment. It's really pointing to the heart of, I think, of the teaching of freedom, where the Buddha describes the heart as being luminous, or the potentiality of the heart as being luminous and without boundaries. Now, in an ideal world, we would first discover unshakable inner freedom and contentment. And in the light of that discovery, we would then lay down the patterns and habits of agitation and craving. Now, perhaps this happens for some very rare practitioners I've never heard of. But for the rest of us, we are asked to cultivate contentment, to unbind our hearts from the grip of agitation and craving by making a commitment to contentment, which is making an inner commitment actually to sufficiency, to an understanding of sufficiency. And one of the ways that the belief in insufficiency, I think, makes its mark is in the form of the mental state of doubt, self-doubt. I think that's one of the very visible faces of this belief in insufficiency. Doubt in our capacity for transformation, doubt in our possibility of genuine healing and liberation, doubt in our capacity really to walk the path. But what we see that doubt does is that doubt weakens that commitment that we're asked to make to sufficiency, to contentment. Doubt has the power to weaken our intentionality. Have you ever noticed that? Like you get up in the morning, you know, and you might decide or to bring the intention to have really a day that's truly dedicated to calmness, you know? And how long does it last, you know? I mean, isn't it amazing? The moment you face the uncooperative mind or the uncooperative body, you know, you kind of like, I'm going for a hike, you know, or I'm going for a nap. Now that whole intentionality or commitment to have a truly day dedicated to wakefulness has just been subverted by the first kind of passing unpleasant experience. Have you ever kind of got up in the morning with the intention to have a day where you're really dedicated to being patient and kind? I have. And I've really seen that intentionality waver, you know, the first time something goes amiss. You know, much better idea here. You know, I'm going to read a book, you know, or it's time to go and do something else. But the wavering, if you really see this toxic loop, you know, that doubt undermines intentionality and makes us waver. Now that wavering actually it kind of reinforces or convinces us of an incapacity. Convinces us of incapacity. So you can see that doubt feeds off this hidden belief in insufficiency. Doubt makes us waver in our intention and commitment, and the wavering convinces us of insufficiency. This is a kind of toxic loop that goes round and round. Where does it stop? Not by suppressing doubt, but in reality, by stepping into intentionality and commitment. And I think this is something we step into, just like we step into the practice of contentment. Perhaps we commit to just being present with one breath. Perhaps we commit to just being present in one step. Perhaps we commit ourselves, you know, to just this moment of patience or this moment of kindness. And every time we do that, we are stepping into, every time we step into commitment, we are stepping into a sense of possibility. And it liberates, it begins to liberate the grip of doubt and insufficiency. And I think it's so important to see that as a practice, that contentment may be no further away than that step we take into the cultivation of contentment in every moment of discontent. I'd like to end with a poem translated from the, I think, a Sri Lankan yogi. It's kind of when the thundering storm cloud roars out in the mist and torrents of rain fill the paths of the birds, nestled in a mountain cave, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When along the rivers the tumbling flowers bloom in winding wreaths adorned with verdant color, seated on the bank, glad-minded, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When in the depths of night in a lonely forest, the rain deva drizzles and the fanged beasts cry, nestled in a mountain cave, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When restraining themselves in their discursive thoughts, devoid of fear and agitation, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When one is happy, unobstructed, unassailed, having ended all entanglement, the yogi meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. Thank you. So I want to take a moment to stand and stretch, and then we've got some time if anybody has any questions or reflections. Anything anybody wants to raise or would like to raise? Yeah.
I'm curious about the relationship or cultivation of gratitude. If those two things are the same or supportive of each other.
So the question is about the relationship of gratitude to contentment and whether those qualities are the same. I think, in my understanding, contentment is not, again, not just one particular feeling, but very much embraces this kind of spectrum of understanding. But I also really do feel in our experience that if we look upon any of those moments when, you know, some of those kind of very wholesome, very lovely qualities are present, you know, such as gratitude, such as appreciation, you will find a sense, a real flavor of contentment in those moments. Because, you know, when we think, reflect on something like gratitude, you know, there isn't a sense of insufficiency in that moment. There is a sense of thankfulness. You know, there is a sense of enough. We're not looking, I'm grateful for this, but I'd like more of that. You know, not, you know, it's a genuine moment where there is that sense of enough. And I think it's why the Buddha really, you know, really encourages people to look at the moments in their lives when some of those very wholesome, very lovely qualities are present, because there is a taste of contentment there. But again, not to pin contentment to be this experience versus that experience, you know, but to really see contentment as something that is being understood in those moments. That is actually being to look at the wisdom of those moments and not just the felt sense of them. And that would be my understanding. The second.
Okay.
The second. So it was a question about the meaning of the word in the term way that I'm using insufficiency, whether it was referring to, you know, something external, lacking, or whether it's referring much more to an internal belief system. And certainly the second. I mean, there are plenty of people in this world where insufficiency is the name of the day, in terms of just having enough to eat or enough shelter. And the Buddha never, you know, whenever the Buddha talked about, for example, these terms, he was always speaking about emotional climate, you know, emotional climate, psychological, emotional confusion and struggle.
Thank you, that does help.
I actually think these are the moments when it's most important. Can you hear the question? So the question was, you know, living in a reality of being unemployed and not knowing where the rent is coming from, you know, and just being aware of disquietude with that, you know, and on one level I would say that's totally human to feel that, to feel disquietude in the face of uncertainty, you know? So I certainly wouldn't want to encourage you to sort of get into a position of feeling judgmental about that. But at the same time, I mean, first of all, remember where the Buddha taught this teaching of the four great contentments? It's one of the poorest places of earth and one of the poorest times of earth. He wasn't teaching this to middle class people who had everything secure and certain. It's very important to remember that. I think it's also very important to remember that, you know, it looks a lot easier to cultivate a contented and free heart when everything is going well and easily in our lives, you know. And sometimes that can be very true. And sometimes, yeah, you know, we actually don't even know how much contentment and freedom we've cultivated inwardly until we are in these very, very situations in our life when our health is falling apart or our financial situation is falling apart or things that we've relied upon are no longer there to be relied upon. Actually, you know, these are hard practice moments. But, you know, it's very important to acknowledge that. And it's very easy to also, very important to acknowledge these are the moments that most easily send us into states of panic and uncertainty and fear. You know, and if there's ever a moment in our life when we're asked to more and more cultivate that untangling of the heart, to find those moments of stillness where you actually really can feel that you have refuge inwardly, where you can actually find that sense of contentment and stillness, these are the moments. Are we done? Are we content? Yes, we're content. Or tired. Well, it feels like what? Yes, sorry. I teach every February in Switzerland. If you ever care to come and join. Yes, Jenny.
Yeah, this is a difficult thing for students, but I want to go to the retreat tomorrow, and I had arrived, and I've lost the contact, and I said, was it you? Oh, great. I couldn't remember your name, I couldn't remember anything.
Okay, safe journeys home. Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.